You're listening to episode 7 of the Where Are Your Keys Language Fluency Game podcast with me, Willem Larson, recorded on March 23rd, 2010. Episode, Evan and I talk about the new technique that I coined called money talks. What does it mean when we coin a new technique? It simply means that we've acknowledged something that can accelerate the acquisition of fluent proficiency in language. That's all it means. And by pointing it out, it allows us to think about it and use it. In this conversation, I discover a little bit of what Evan was doing those 8 years before I met him when he was working on the language fluency game and working on issues of indigenous language revitalization in our public schools and colleges and universities. I will make one small note before we hop into that long car ride where Evan and I have our conversation heading up to Seattle from Portland. I mentioned the Kalamaya language and during our conversation, and I'm not sure whether it's the speech community is located in Peru or Ecuador. Well, it turns out it's Bolivia. And also Evan, in thanking a long list of people who've been really supportive of language, indigenous language learning and public institutions, he thanks Sandra Friels, a PhD at the department chair at PSU, in foreign languages and literatures, but gets her name wrong. He calls her Susan. So we apologize for that, Sandra. With that, let's hop in the car and listen in on the conversation.
You know, one thing I mentioned a technique. Oh, you'll like this.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. I coined a technique name.
Ooh.
Oh, you're actually really going to like this. So remember we discovered in one of the recent podcasts that Dustin has been asked to teach the staff at Squamish Valley 2 days a week in Where Your Key Squamish. So, and there's also the fact that the Kalamaya language with only 100, 150 speakers in, I think it's Peru, maybe Ecuador, but I think it's Peru. They only have 100, 150 speakers, and it's been that way for several hundred years at least. And when they're wondering, how do they do that? Well, it turns out that they can maintain a tiny speaker population because they get paid. They get paid. Kalamaya is a technical language for ritual and healing that is passed from master to healing master to male teenage apprentice. It's very specific, very niche, and it's not going anywhere. It's doing fine because they get paid. So the technique, drum roll. Money talks.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, money talks. It does. Money talks.
Yeah.
Money, and you know, if Where Are Your Keys is a thing that is, Where Are Your Keys will get you a job in a very little amount of time. A person with fairly limited language ability can clearly take a community of speakers, jump them up a notch, just, you know, in what, an hour and a half?
Yeah.
After a couple of days worth of training is really the significant impact that we are trying to make.
Yeah.
I mean, giving people that kind of ability, that kind of technical command of teaching and that kind of solid command of their language, even though it's not a lot of it, it's a solid command of a very limited amount, which if everyone in their community could speak that solid limited amount, their language would improve and become stronger. So even if we just create jobs where you have one guy who is the what is that game player, and that's all he does is go around the whole community and just play what is that with people, that is certainly worth a paycheck. That is worth money if you are, you know, interested in keeping your language alive, especially if you're you know, one of these gaming casino tribes that has an amount of money, and it's kind of funny because you go into these lobbies of the of these, you know, casinos, and you ask some of the employees, you know, what tribe is this? You know, sometimes some of them don't even know. And then, you know, and some of them do, and then, you know, well, can you say anything? And that seems to be, like, the big popular tourist question. It's like, well, hey, say something in your language.
Right.
And you know, you get a lot of blank stares. I've been doing this experiment for a long time, right. And you get a lot of blank stares. And that doesn't necessarily make your casino more money. You know, people want to go where they feel like they're contributing their cash dollars to some kind of cultural thing. It's a funny thing. You know, they're like, they're gambling, but it's almost like they're gambling for a charity cause.
Right. Exactly.
It's like, this, your gambling supports our tribe and our culture.
Right,
thank
right.
you. And everybody sort of buys into that. They're like, well, yeah, I know. But if they don't have a real solid connection to that, because when they walk through the door, people didn't greet them in, you know, some sort of sound, and
right.
you know, that it's not to say that that's a wash, but it, but certainly the money value diminishes a bit.
Yeah.
So a long time ago, when I first started into this Wear Your Keys realm, this is exactly the reason that I got into this, was because I noticed that, especially in Oregon at the time in 2001, 2001, the Oregon University system did not have a memorandum of understanding to deal with people who spoke their native language. They had this sort of blanket kind of concept with ACTFL that says, hey, if you can speak your language to an ACTFL intermediate mid, we'll give you your Bachelor of Arts, you know, requirement for your second learned language. But that really wasn't communicated well at all with the different tribes and language groups, and really wasn't even widely understood by the language department deans. And I know this because in 2001, I called every single one of them
yeah.
in Oregon and had a lengthy conversation with them, only to find out that, you know, most of them didn't even know that there were any Oregon languages left.
Right.
And were interestingly not aware that the colleges where their offices were located, what language was spoken traditionally on that land.
Right.
So I thought that was very interesting. But the bigger issue to all that was, if you can't get a degree major in your area of study, so let's say I'm a history major. Well, now I can go to master's in teaching school, and I can get a degree, a master's in education, teaching certificate, to teach history in high school.
Yeah.
And with that history, I can teach government, and I can teach history, and I can teach some, you know, civics and stuff like that. I can't teach math.
Right.
Unless I have a specific endorsement that says I can teach math. But in my primary area of study, that is my Bachelor of Arts major, is the area of study that my primary endorsement has to be.
Sure.
So that means that if I get a primary endorsement in Spanish, I had to have graduated with a major in Spanish from university.
Okay.
Well, how can you go back to your home community and teach, you know, let's say, at the time I was really concerned with Klamath. So, you know, how can you go back to your hometown of Klamath and get a job in Klamath High School and teach Klamath? Well, you have to have a major in Klamath
right.
to get your teaching certificate. Well, I mean, if you can't even get your language itself to be honored at the Bachelor of Arts level as your second learned language because you've managed to acquire an intermediate mid ability at that, and you have somebody at the tribe who can verify that ability, and then you're going to have to run through some hassle at the university to get that recognized, which in 2001 was certainly the case, then there was no way you were ever going to get a job at the high school to actually teach. Now, Senate Bill 690, back in 1998-99, started running through this sort of idea that, hey, we need to get some elderly language teachers into the classroom.
Yeah.
Well, we're not going to make them go to university because they're 80. So we're not going to make them go get a teaching license. So we'll have this emergency teaching license system that says that if you have an ability in your language, we will give you and if you can be certified and verified and approved, vetted by your tribe with a letter from the language department or the council, we, the state of Oregon, and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission will give you an emergency Indian languages teaching license so that you can go into a school and you can teach.
Yeah.
Very specifically, it has to be your language, so it has to be Klamath.
Right.
So it can't be math in Klamath. It's Klamath, and that, oh, that's a good one. Klamath, no. So you can't teach Klamath. You can teach Klamath, and that's it.
Yeah.
So that really sort of limited the different types of classes that you could go into. So then that means that, like, a high school would have to open a section in a classroom to say, this is Klamath High School, Klamath 101.
Yeah.
Well, the trouble is that the school doesn't have the budget to open up Klamath 101 and then to bring in a teacher. And, you know, it's just a huge administrative hassle. It's a step in the right direction, the Senate Bill 690, because at least it allows for some kind of negotiated road that a person can travel down in order to kind of gain momentum to getting that kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
It's not a complete roadblock to making classes actually happen inside of high schools. But it certainly doesn't go the entire way to say that, well, if you can somehow manage to open up a section of your classroom, of your high school, to do a Klamath class, then is the school board going to recognize that as a a worthwhile endeavor for the students? Because, you know, I mean, because the students are going to have to go through some sort of issue where they have the ability to then take that language and go on to college with it. So if colleges are having a hard time dealing with getting a person certified and into the classroom, and they're having a hard time dealing with the ACTFL requirements to get their Bachelor of Arts, it's this whole next step to then get the universities to recognize a high school class and then have that correlate into a college degree requirement standard. Okay, so you have a class. You have a Senate Bill 690 emergency certified teacher. You get a student through high school Klamath 101 and 201 and get them up to an intermediate mid-level. You certify them. Now they go to college, which is great because now they don't actually have to take like Spanish or French or Swahili, something that doesn't necessarily apply to them and their community. They can get their Bachelor of Art requirement met, which saves them a lot of time because now they don't have to sit through a Spanish class, which is quite an endeavor. But then you still can't get a major in Klamath. Now, if you can't get a major in Klamath, that means that you're not ever going to be able to replace the Senate Bill 690 emergency teacher with an actual hired by the school district with benefits and with a steady job position at your school. That just isn't going to happen. And that was my goal back in 2000-2001 when I realized this, was just really start paving the way for this to happen. And since then, the Oregon University system and most language deans that I talk to, especially I'd like to mention Dan Morris at Southern Oregon University, who really, you know, stepped up, and that whole department really was one of the leaders in making sure that these kind of steps were taken. Next, I would say, is PSU.
Yeah.
and Susan Friels at the PSU language department, who is in full support of native languages and was incredibly gracious with her time with me and was really supportive of having languages, all languages, in high schools and then being able to offer credit for them at the university level as long as they were actively calibrated testing system. Yeah. Also, the people out at Eastern Oregon University who have a really sort of model distance education program, which can certainly work into, you know, returning to your home community to study. And then there's Lane Community College, who stepped up and put Chinookwawa language as a 101 and 201 offering for their language requirement as a transfer option to the Oregon University system. So there are my recommendations and plugs and thank yous. But still a long way to go. Yeah. Money talks.
Yeah.
Money talks. And how do we get people in the community able to do something with their language that's going to make them money?
Yeah.
Really, that's the whole crux of this. So, yeah, I love it. Technique, money talks. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure. That was quite a little jaunt down history lane, wasn't it?
That was great. That was great.
Well, but that's certainly been my experience. And, you know, I just want people to be aware of that story so that people remember, you know, that this is by no means out of the woods. And in that, you know, since that 2000-2001, so it's been about 10 years now since I started down this road, some languages have certainly disappeared.
Yeah.
Certainly. And out of Oregon, out of Washington, I can name three off the top of my head, and I'm certain that there's about three to four others that I never really had a good idea or handle on how many actual speakers there were left in 2000, as opposed to now in 2010. But certainly this lag time has had a, and will have in the future, a massive societal impact.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really want to go into all the issues of the negative issues of losing your language, but certainly anyone with any kind of ability to think would say that loss of language is costly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you spoke about sort of the navigating the bureaucracy and getting paid through government systems and public, you know, getting public money, getting publicly paid through schools and government programs. Also, but that's not what's going on with Dustin. Now, and I'm not saying he's getting paid yet, you know, but it's clearly it's in the cards. Like, it's a matter of time. He's interacting with programs that have budgets and he's providing an important service, and everybody involved is aware that that is worth compensating. And I think here's what I think will need to happen. So when we coin techniques, we simply, a lot of times, we're simply observing what is something to notice and to make room for. And like the coining of money talks is not to say that really there's that anybody besides us is getting paid for Wear Your Keys. You know, besides us and Chinook Nation Wear Your Keys instructor, Justin Robinson earns a little bit, you know, and, but there's not a whole lot of, oh wow, you learn Wear Your Keys, you're going to get paid, you know. And I think that the economic, an economic factor is a huge factor in language acquisition, and the more we can demonstrate and start creating a history of people either earning a living or increasing the living they earn, the more people be like, shoot, I want to learn my language so I can get paid and I can earn a living and raise a family, have a home, you know? I mean, this isn't like get paid, like get quick cash and live it big. This is like earn a living.
And that's the sense in which money talks, not in bling, you know, and gold rings or whatever, but in the sense of I can raise a family because I know how to teach my language and I know how to speak it extraordinarily well. So that is the heart of money talks. And so applying it is a matter of simply demonstrating that that your language can indeed earn you a living.
Well, so let's apply it a little. So I have a specific application for it, which is $30,000 a year. Uh-huh. If you can pay someone $30,000 a year to have it be their full-time job, to go around to every member of your nation, anyone who you can get your hands on, and play What Is That? Up to Want, Have, Give, Take.
Yeah.
And even if you can just play What Is That?
Yeah.
With anyone you can get your hands on, have, especially in tribes that have government systems, and have it be part of your daily work activity or your weekly work activity that you are going to make a half an hour to an hour for when someone let's call it Dustin Rivers just for fun.
Yeah.
Right. So let's say Squamish Nation hires Dustin Rivers to go around and play What Is That with every community member. There's some 5,000 community members. Was these, is that
am 3,500. Well, that's just in North Vancouver, I think.
Okay. All right, so 3,500 folks. Okay, I'm just trying to get a pool sort of narrowed down.
Yeah.
There's 3,500 folks. I don't know how many people actually work for the tribe, who are like in positions, you know, payroll positions by the tribe.
Yeah.
It's got to be a couple hundred, anyway. So you say every one of those couple hundred folks has the expectation as part of their job that they are going to play. So they're going to play a game as part of their job.
Right.
A half an hour per whatever that fills Dustin's schedule from, you know, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, you can easily do the math to kind of figure out how many people for how many time slots per week that's going to fill. It's going to fill up a full-time position quite quickly, especially if you have this expectation that your minimum exposure is going to be once a week. And really, your minimum exposure to really make use of the $30,000 that you're going to pay an instructor like this is twice a week. So basically, twice a week for a half an hour is a minimum. And all right, so you have all these other health and wellness programs that you build into your work day that generally companies are getting on board with and are okay with, especially if it's going to be something that's going to increase your cultural knowledge and therefore allow you to not only increase the stability of the tribe, but also increase the stability of families, of the bureaucracy itself, of culture. If that's the thing that's going to happen, then you could fill up a time card pretty quickly with a one-person show like Dustin Rivers going around and playing What Is That? So you pay somebody like that $30,000.
Yeah.
He goes around and he does What Is That?
Yeah.
That's all he does.
Yeah.
He eventually is going to start realizing who are the people who are picking up this activity very quickly.
Uh-huh.
And he is going to start playing What Is That? Whose is that with those folks.
Yeah.
And eventually what's going to happen is that he's not going to have as much time to play What Is That with everyone.
Right.
But he is going to certainly groom a successor through this process in probably a span of about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
Who could go around town and who could take his place as the What Is That player.
Right.
So within 3 or 4 months, you have another person who comes on board at another $30,000.
Yeah.
And this is a full-time position with benefits. I mean, and $30,000, that's like, what is that? That's like $10 an hour or something, like 10, 12 an hour. It's not a lot of money, but it's certainly a living wage.
Right.
It's a comparable wage to, say, McDonald's or something like that, with this piece in it that really builds a massive amount of cultural stability right into the framework of your government system, of your community.
Right.
So within a year, you could easily have now a person who is playing What Is That?
Yeah.
You have another person who is playing What Is That? Whose Is That?
Yeah.
And you have another person playing What Is That? Whose Is That? And Want, Have, Give, Take.
Yeah.
you certainly, at that point, after 1 year, you have three full-time employees, your budget's going to run about $100,000 a year, and you have home visit doctors of culture and language and community who are intertwining all of the different folks and who are building these rich lacings and webbing between community members, government people. It's going to open up a whole bunch of just communication lines that weren't necessarily there before because you have these liaisons of culture. And now this isn't to say that these are by any means going to replace different people working in, say, immersion preschools, immersion elementary schools, language programs themselves. This is certainly something in addition to all of that, but with a more focused intention, because they are going to be the people who are developing this next round of games and the next round of specific lessons, like what we're doing at Chinook Wawa Night with the the family.
Right.
Where we have a group of four or five people that are really cooking the family lesson in a Wear Your Keys fashion, and then really cooked the other night the first stage of the basketry lessons in a Wear Your Keys style.
Yeah.
So I think these three or four people that eventually get hired to do this kind of very specific targeted gameplay. Are going to be the people who then sit around with the elder speaker and who language hunt these very specific, very culturally rich lesson plans. And by lesson plan, I mean even to the point of a university-style lesson plan, but arranged through the Wear Your Keys lens, which certainly any lesson plan designed through a Wear Your Keys lens and through Wear Your Keys gameplay and that team approach to designing a lesson is certainly going to, if not meet, completely outpace any expectation from a university teaching language curriculum format. So that's my specific advice on money talks, and then the next piece is pay your teenagers.
Yeah, right.
Pay your teenagers a token amount for playing games. There's a 13-year-old, almost 14, in Eugene that I've been paying, and I pay her $10 for half an hour. And she always, she sits there and she does the math and she's, calculating her fortune.
Yeah.
She's like, well, if I teach for an hour, that means you're going to pay me $20. And if I teach for 10 days straight, you're going to pay me $1,000. And I've always said to her, yes, I will.
Yeah.
She never has because she's, 13.
Right,
so, she calculates the riches.
Excited, yeah.
And so she's like, and the light in her eyes is like, I'm going to make money. I'm going to make money. I have motivation. She got out her, daily planner. And she started penciling in dates and started calculating it up. And she came back to me and she hit me with this figure. She was like, you realize that if I do all this, you're going to owe me $800 by the end of December? And I looked at her straight and I was like, make me.
Yeah.
Bring it.
Yeah.
Do it. I would love it. Go for it. Please. And she was like, really? And that really gave her some motivation. The moments that she was spending in our casual cultural evening really turned around, and she really became a right-hand man for me. Because
yeah.
She came up to me and said, hey, who do you want me to go with now? Hey, is it time for my lesson? Hey, I want to do a lesson now so I can get paid. And really, I ended up shelling out $210 in, the span of 2 months.
Yeah.
For $100 a month, to really create a kid, a 13-year-old, who was fully capable of teaching what is that, whose is that, and want, have, give, take.
Yeah.
Was that worth $200? Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely worth $200. I would shell that out every day.
Yeah.
So pay your teenagers a token amount for showing up to class and then for starting to brew that attitude of like, hey, you are going to be the one in charge of playing. What is that?
Yeah.
Next week, are you ready? Hey, next week, are you ready? Are you ready to get paid? Yeah. Are you? Because I'm ready to pay you.
Yeah.
And having that attitude, really, so what's that cost in a year? At the rate that I was doing that with that 13-year-old, it was once a week for about a half hour a night, which turned into, it was about $100 for a month, maybe 110 or something like that. So that turns out to be $1,200 a year. So maybe $1,500 a year for one teenager. I mean, if your community can't get together $1,500 to support a 14-year-old, a 13-14-year-old who has an interest in becoming a very well-skilled, technically capable teacher, I mean, have a car wash or something.
Yeah, right.
Get some kind of money together.
Yeah,
and I think what the story you just told illustrates the nature of money talks. Because we all know that if you pay somebody something, if you pay somebody for something that they enjoy doing anyway, they tend to enjoy the thing less and they start being in it for money. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about something different. We're talking about that if you... money talks when you demonstrate that what you want to impart to somebody can help them build a life. Is a serious adult matter, right? That's what Evan was that's what you were demonstrating, was that this is real. This is a real matter. This isn't a silly kid playtime anymore. Although certainly that's how we wanted to feel like that. But this is an adult activity that has adult rewards to it. So that along with the satisfaction of playing the game and learning your language, you know it's a sustainable venture. You know that your time invested in it is being rewarded on many levels. You're not in it for the money, but the money is demonstrating the value of it.
And, you know, there's another kid up in Portland, a 12-year-old guy. I'm not naming these kids' names because they're minors and I don't have permission to out them. But we have a group of students coming from the Endangered Native Languages program up at PSU, taught by Nario Kono. And they were coming down to our Chinook Nights and, kind of exploring the local scene, really, which I give these guys full credit for doing. Actually, thank you publicly for doing that and not just staying in a classroom and talking about language revitalization, but actually coming and participating and learning a language and being part of the revitalization effort. One of my best feelings is when this 12-year-old kid, after coming for 7 times or 8 times over the span of like 6 months, he'd come for a couple weeks and then we wouldn't see him for a month, and he'd come back a couple weeks, wouldn't see him again. So he sat down with a couple of these university kids and he taught them a faster, a more elegant, a more concise language curriculum lesson than I'm sure any of them have ever had in their lives. By a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
And so the 12-year-old teaching university kids was just a fantastic experience for that kid.
Yeah.
To see that guy owning this language and owning his ability to command it and to teach it,
yeah,
as sort of this like, yeah, I'm bad.
Yeah,
I teach university students.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to be, I don't have to have a PhD. I don't have to be 50 to teach this.
Yeah.
I'm 12 and I'm teaching people who are, linguists.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And that's that kind of sense of place that money talks.
Right.
Because that's money. He's seeing that as like, oh, these kids are paying at the university to get taught, and they're coming to me for additional instruction. That's worth not only status, but that's going to be worth some money.
Right.
In the very near future,
right.
With Justin, you know, that's something that, that's a very real thing. He is making an amount of money that he's able to use on things that he wants to use, and it's enough that right now he's 16 and a half, almost 17. Been working with him since he was just about 12, a little 12 and a half maybe. He has 3 years of teaching experience. He's 16 and a half and have 3 years of teaching experience.
Yeah.
When these kids graduate from college, these just regular kids who go through college, they, you know, go to high school, then they pop out of high school at 18, they go to college, they get to their bachelor's at 21, 22, and then they go to the teaching teaching college, master's in teaching, 1 year program. They get out when they're 23 and have zero actual on the ground teaching experience. This kid's 16 with 3 years of language teaching experience and training. And now his job is what he does is he now is grooming to teach the teachers.
Right.
So he, at 16 and a half, is a teacher trainer and is going to, by the time he's 18, if everything works out, is going to have 3 years of teaching experience and then a year and a half of teacher training experience. So by the time he's 18, that is a guy who is prepared to enter the workforce or prepared to enter college. That to me is a preparation for college. I don't find that high school is actually an adequate preparation for college or for the workforce. I think that graduating college, the level of skill that kids graduate college at, I actually think that is the skill level that students should have to enter college or to enter the workforce, not the high school level. So I think that by kickstarting this kind of teaching idea with these young kids really gives them that step in that direction, so that by the time they do get to ready to go to college, then they have a direction because they know that money is talking now. That they're not just sort of in college to sort of see where it takes them, but they walk through the door the first day with the mastery of an ability that they can now apply to some other subject area. They've learned it through the lens of teaching and learning language. Well, that certainly applies to the teaching and learning of math, music, history, now whatever subject they want to apply that to, knowing that the money that they've invested and the time that they've invested as a high schooler is going to pay off, because they're going to have an easier time in college, they're going to get better grades, and they're going to get a better job because of it. So, and really the parents see that as well. Like the parents who are bringing their kids and the family members who are bringing their kids to this, they certainly see that and want that kind of a life for their kids. They want that kind of a professional option for their kids, who at the moment may not be seeing that option, or the parents may not have the ability to, you know, pay their kids away through college or some kind of thing. So they're going to have to do it somehow. And, you know, to give the kids this professional option of getting some money for doing something that they like, playing a game, passing back and forth sticks, rocks, and pens. And as soon as they get their first job at McDonald's, where they're having to work and get all dirty and, that's certainly going to open their eyes to this sort of other option of, oh, maybe I want to be learning and teaching my language instead of learning and teaching McDonald's.
Training the new hires at McDonald's. And yeah, this is how you scrub the grease trap or whatever. Well, you know, and so it's really impossible to overstate the importance of the economic factor in language loss and language extinction. Like, all over the world right now, adolescents are learning English or Chinese or some other main language instead of their home language. They're abandoning their home language, and fairly quickly, like, you know, 8, 9, 10, they're realizing that the language that either their grandparents or maybe their parents if they're lucky enough to still have their parents speaking it, is not economically relevant. And the world of adulthood, of standing out, of having value, of being attractive or successful by whatever standards, that world is defined by some other more commercial language spoken by more people, like Russian is killing a lot of Siberian languages, and not because Russian is evil, but because Russian is the language of commerce and success in that area. So how do you turn this around? Human beings need to eat and raise families and have clothes and put gas in their cars if they have cars. And so you've got to acknowledge the economic factor to say, hey, just, you know, just learn your language because it's spiritual and it's important for traditional. Well, it used to be you learned your language because that's how you caught the deer, that's how you raised your kids, that's how you successfully wove a basket. Not knowing your language well enough meant that you wouldn't make it through the winter, meant that your kids would get sick and die because you didn't know how to speak to them, people in your community, other forces that you acknowledge. So in order to turn that around again, one way or another, you've got to connect learning language and revitalizing culture with adulthood and success and value and being able to raise a family and have a life to literally make a living. Language has to become relevant to living and making a living again. And it's, although I personally acknowledge that, whether or not money's involved, it's a pretty subtle point for an adolescent who's like, wow, they got stuff I don't have, you know. They have a house, I don't, you know, I don't have anything. Like, I'm going to go to the city and leave this small town because I want, you know, to be successful. I don't want to just be, you know, cooling my heels, doing nothing, being nowhere. So that, I think that's why this is such an important topic. Is it central to language extinction itself and to really the central drive to what is killing languages all over the world?
Anyone who can sign up to Want, Have, Give, Take really has an ability now to communicate with any deaf person who comes through the door and can meet those basic needs.
Yeah.
I want, I have, you get, I take. That just that basic get your needs met thing. So my sister was working at a little travel lodge motel in downtown Portland a while back.
Yeah.
And she was learning sign language, and she was a housekeeper. And well, housekeeper and kind of like part-time desk clerk girl. And one time she had this deaf person come in, and she could sign a little bit, so the deaf person was completely, you know, like, hey, great, somebody I can communicate with. A week later, 10 deaf people came to their hotel.
Wow.
Because there was some sort of convention or some sort of link that was going on in Portland where there were these recurring deaf events.
Wow.
And it got out that there was this girl at this hotel who could speak sign. And so they all started, well, not they all started, but more deaf people started going to that hotel.
Yeah.
The hotel manager realized that.
Yeah.
And then made sure that he had her on hand during these deaf events to run the counter.
Yeah.
It made him money.
Yeah.
So certainly that's this extra benefit of doing Wear Your Keys, is that you actually learn a commercial applicable
yeah.
language and be able to write down on your application, yes, I speak some sign language.
Right.
And for then the manager of some, you know, of said business to say, well, how much do you speak? You can say, I can get transactions done. I can make transactions. And well, I mean, now you're talking commercial language. Oh,
right.
You can make transactions happen?
Yeah.
Well, shoot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want you in my business. And then, of course, the whole concept of speed to language acquisition is based on transactions.
Right.
Yeah, it's exactly. The beg, borrow, steal list. Want, have, give, take, and then, yeah. You know, trade, bring, borrow, loan,
right,
buy,
the, that's
sell,
the first thing you can do.
Steal.
In
yeah.
Language, you learn to borrow your keys.
It's a commercial transaction. That's the irony. I mean, it's all pretty funny. I mean, and to reiterate, so when you learn a language with where your keys, you're actually learning three languages. Of course, you're learning your target language, whether that's Spanish or Chinook Wawa or Squamish or whatever. You're learning the bridge language that you're choosing to carry it, whether that's American Sign Language or more specifically, Pidgin Sign English. Maybe that's British Sign Language. Maybe that's Italian Sign Language. Whatever your signed language is that you're choosing to carry the language, you're learning that too. And then you're learning a third language, which is a technical language. And it's the wear your keys technique language. Okay? So it's essentially like, you know, engineers have their jargon, quantum physicists have their jargon. This technical language of wear your keys techniques is the pattern language of teaching and learning. And it allows you to speak with other highly trained wear your keys educators and I mean, really, I believe that it's going to emerge as a really important language to understand and to be able to speak. But, you know, we're getting there. The other thing is, okay, say you're a Chulim speaker in Siberia in the middle of nowhere. I watched the movie The Linguists recently, and they visited this village of Chulim people, and some Russians live there too, and the mayor of the town was like, oh, those Chulim people are dirty people and, you know, gutter people, and they get drunk. They're so uncool. One shot of vodka will get them drunk. They're lily livered and all this kind of thing. So basically uncool to be Chulim and to speak Chulim, and not worth anything. And this wasn't lost on people of Chulim descent. They're all Russian speakers, and Chulim is dying out. And so the linguists, in this case, tried to find a Chulim speaker. Got lucky, realized their taxi driver guide was a speaker. Took him to some other speakers, and took him to a house where grandma spoke. And she had a granddaughter who did not speak. Maybe understood a little Chulim. I doubt it, though. But she absolutely spoke Russian. Now, imagine teaching that granddaughter where your keys and saying, listen, you're going to learn Russian. You're going to learn to hunt Russian like a fiend. You're going to be more fluent in Russian than Russian speakers. You're going to be so good at learning language. Not only that, you're going to learn English. You're going to be crazy good at learning English. Any tourist that comes to town anywhere, you're going to be able to hunt the crap out of them, right? Hey, grandma speaks a dying language. You know what? Even though they don't respect it around here, learn Chulim. Keep it. One day there's going to be an archaeologist or a linguist who's going to come up and say, I want to learn Chulim. And you're like, show me the money, you know? Or maybe you don't believe me. Maybe you've got a lot, you know, you've got a chip on your shoulder about Chulim. You don't want to learn it. Okay, fine. In a few years, you're going to change your mind. Probably when you're 29 is about when that happens. If you're lucky enough, grandma's still going to be alive. At that time, you are going to hunt the crap out of grandma, and you are going to have the skills, right?
And a community,
right? You're going to build a community of speakers. You're going to know how to build a community. You're going to be, so everybody will be speaking English, everybody will be speaking Russian, and everybody will be speaking Chulim, right? These are your skills as a wear your keys instructor. You know how to revitalize community around any language, and you know how to personally hunt any language. So, I mean, that's really what we're talking about. In the world today, what languages replace other languages, because it's language is a biological act. Mothers are the most amazing language teachers you'll ever meet. And then when their children turn into teenagers, they're no longer the most amazing language teachers you'll ever meet. It only works with babies, right? And infants and toddlers, and their capacity fades over time because it's a biological relationship. It only gets triggered when the mom's body is lit up, when their mind is lit up by interacting with a baby or a toddler or a young child. So when the children become teenagers, now the mom knows it's their job to correct their pronunciation or correct how they say this or that or give them new words, right? They're building their vocabulary. That's a biological act. So what's happening is we're reclaiming those early years, and we're making it so it's possible to restart that all over again. But because that doesn't exist right now, languages like Russian, like Chinese, like English, like whatever it is, and really it's, you know, Indonesian, whatever the language is, there's a bunch of tribal languages that it's kicking out. I mean, I'm sure Zulu has kicked out other, you know, tribal languages.
Chinookwawa
had kicked out 20 or more languages at the Grand Ronde Reservation. So it's not that any one language...
And English kicked it out.
Yeah, then English just kicked it out, right? When the hops fields popped up and it was time to learn English if you want to get paid by the hops farmers. So the important thing is to understand that it's not about any one language, but it's about a relationship to languages. Learn 10 languages. English isn't going to kill you. But just make sure your lineal heritage language is kept. And make sure, hey, know 4 or 5 commercial languages. Why not? Sign language, Russian, English, Chinese. Learn them all. Learn all your neighbors' heritage languages. Sure, fine. Chinookwawa, Klamath, Squamish, whatever it is, right? So what we're doing is changing a relationship to language acquisition, not fighting a losing battle and trying desperately to hold on to one heritage language. That's the key. And that you're changing your relationship to languages is the money talks piece. And one way or another, making sure if you're sharing where your keys with someone else, money talks means you're looking for that angle. As you look at into the eyes of this adolescent, this teenager, you're going, I know this person. As they're growing older, they're now turning into a teenager, and they're now starting to individuate and want to become an adult and want to demonstrate adult abilities and to make a living, demonstrate that they can make a living. So money talks means an appreciation for that, and knowing that if you find the angle at which money goes into their hands, or a house goes into their hands, or a vehicle goes into their hands, or livestock goes into their hands, whatever are the signifiers of an adult life, an ability to raise a family and to be successful in that cultural environment, that's what you have to figure out how to get to them. And to demonstrate that where your keys and being able to teach and learn languages and other skills is going to get them. That's money talks. Now, to pull this all the way back to the beginning, we are using. Evan's already mentioned that he's found some application for this, and getting the 12-year-old paid, and getting the 6-year-old paid a small amount to show that the game is serious. But in your communities, on reservations, wherever you are, you're going to have to figure out other applications of this, and we have yet to get to really demonstrate that where your keys is going to get you that 30 grand. And if you can do that, if you can make that happen where you live, that's when money talks really starts doing the work. That's what you want to make happen.
Well, and the sooner that people can make that happen in each of their individual communities, the sooner that will happen along a variety of communities.
Yeah.
As soon as, you know, certain communities start demonstrating that this is possible, that there is an avenue towards making a living, not a great living, but a living.
Or a great living.
Or a great living.
I mean, certainly.
I'm saying 30,000 is a minimum.
Right.
I mean, that is a minimum. But what is that? What's poverty level in the United States right now?
You know the line?
Geez, I think it's 6,500, I think.
Wait, for a year? No, no. No, no, no. It's like 24 grand.
Really?
Like, yeah, for income. Yeah, for income level. It's like, wow. Like the poverty level of a household is 24,000, I think.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's which reflects the actual amount of money that you need to make in order to have, you know, an apartment and food,
yeah,
for an individual, and then it keeps going up. Oh, we're just going over the Skugumchuck River now.
Yeah.
Strong water.
Yeah.
So that's that. If you can make a fantastic living at this, I personally think that it's insane to pay last living fluent speakers less than you pay your tribal councilman, your directors of operations, your anyone, because you have this chance to keep your language alive. And if you forego that chance, then you're really looking into the eyes of sustainability and longevity of your culture and your people and your society, and really making some devastating choices.
Yeah.
If those aren't lining up with your priorities.
Yeah.
So $30,000 is really this the minimum, and to a certain extent a token
and it's
payment.
It's a start at the beginning, isn't it? I mean, what we're not saying is this is only worth 30 grand. We're saying poverty level is 24 grand. Or something along those lines. So pay them 30 grand and make that a beginning place. And, of course, they will demonstrate that they deserve as much as you can pay them. You know? I mean, heck, for all I know, there'll be competition to keep these wear your keys instructors in your hometown, you know, but in the meanwhile, they're creating new instructors all the time. So, I mean, it's a community revitalization method, you know, a community learning method. So 30 grand is the place to start. And really, $10 a night is the place to start. Start somewhere, but know that a Technique Money Talks means, if you're looking into the eyes of an adolescent, the sooner you can make relevant, financially relevant, what you're doing with that Wear Your Keys game and them, the more it'll accelerate their language acquisition. Because then what is our biggest value? The most rapid acquisition of fluent proficiency in a community. That's the only reason we're bringing this up. That's the only reason we say anything. We have no other reason. We're total mercenary, ruthless language instructors. And it just turns out that the necessities of life and the most fundamental human values are what drive language acquisition. That's kind of a big duh if you think about it. But so there it is.
You've been listening to episode 7 of the Wear Your Keys Language Fluency Game podcast with me, Willem Larson, recorded on March 23rd, 2010.